did this to him. Didn't you? You son of a bitch! You did this to him! Didn't you? How could you? How could you?
Welcome to The Shining 237. This is the podcast where we forensically examine Kubrick's horror masterpiece, The Shining, in 2 minute and 37 second bloody chunks. My name is Susan Tekla Triglenska, and we are in episode number 24, where we begin the segment with Wendy saying to Jack, it's okay now, really. And we end this 2 minute and 37 second segment with her saying, how could you? How could you? And him kind of muttering, something like that. I think that was close. I have two fantastic guests this week. First, let me say back on the program, a regular contributor to the podcast 237 is Megan Dooley, all the way from the Best Coast, the West Coast. And she is not only a cinephile, but she's one of my absolute references for horror movies. Welcome back, Megan.
Hi, good to be back.
And we also have this week, I'm extremely happy to have Heidi Bennett. Heidi is part of the Movies by Minute podcast world, which this show is part of. This universe of podcasts that examines movies minute by minute, which started with Star Wars Minute from Pete the Retailer and Alex Robinson. Thanks to them for starting it all. And Heidi has been a wonderful contributor to this universe. She began with Spinal Tap Minute, which is like... Oh my God, what a great choice. That you did in its entirety, right?
Oh yeah. Every metal minute of Spinal Tap. Yeah.
And then you just wrapped up, and I'm so upset that I missed being on the show. You just wrapped up Cabin Minute Cast.
That is correct.
So yeah. It's Cabin in the Woods.
Yes, you got it.
So look at Bradley Whitford and Jenkins.
Oh yeah.
Another fantastic choice. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was really fun.
So have you aired the last episode? What are you at?
No, actually. So we just recorded our final episode, and that we recorded that the first day of April. So I believe, I don't know the exact date, but through April here we'll be done, I think. Yeah.
Okay, great. So everybody... you can find it on iTunes. You can find it in, they have their own website. What other venues are you guys? Stitcher?
Yeah, we're pretty much everywhere. So just whatever your podcatcher of choice, just look for Cabin Minute Cast. We're at Cabin Minute Cast everywhere.
And, and the beauty of podcasts is you can go back and binge listen to the whole thing. And Spinal Tap Minute, of course, how could you not, and then you also, professionally are a coach for multi-creatives. So you have your own little company where you coach people as far as doing creative projects and that kind of thing, right?
Exactly. I coach them over the phone and in person and in groups. So I coach people all over the world. And super fun. And I just love talking with other creative weirdos like myself and probably like you ladies. The more I can surround myself with those people and help them sort of organize their thoughts. And a lot of times with multi-creative people, people that have a lot of multitude of interests, it can be challenging. In fact, we were just talking about this before we started recording, challenging to get our schedules correct and take care of ourselves at the same time and, finish our projects, not leave them flying in the wind.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was dying to be on Cabin Minute Cast. I love that movie. And I'm so upset. Heidi had asked me ages ago, and the time just flies. There's just no time for, we're all working and we're, living our lives and then doing these podcasts out of love. But man, I'm so upset that I didn't get on that. You'll be doing more podcasting, right?
Right. So I have a podcast coming up. And it will be me talking with other creative folks, multi-creative people, and talking about creative process or how we live our lives as maybe as a writer that doesn't go insane and kill everybody.
Yes, you know? Right. No axes.
Exactly.
No drooling. So,
but yeah, I think, you know, rewatching this when we get into it, you know, one of the things that watching this particular section of the movie really brought up to me was that torture that can happen, which obviously Stephen King, you know, like to write about over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But it is a true thing for us as a creative process. It can feel like this incredible, you know, inner struggle. And I thought it would be enjoyable to have people be able to listen and hear, you know, me talk with other musicians and podcasters and artists and illustrators.
You could have have changed everything at the Overlook Hotel if you had been working in 1980, you know, Colorado. If Jack had had any contact with someone like you, all of this could have been prevented, most likely. And there are some who theorize that the entire, you know, message of this movie is about the creative process, you know. It's another interpretation.
For sure.
Okay, so let's, and I'm glad to have a couple ladies on this episode, too, because this is, you know, one of those episodes where it's just good to have a female perspective. So we begin, so they are under the table. And Jack has just woken up from a nightmare. Wendy ran up the stairs and is comforting him. And he says, in the last minute, he said, I had the most terrible nightmare I ever had. It's the most horrible dream I ever had. And she says, it's okay now, really. I dreamed that I killed you and Danny. such a great punchline.
And is he drooling at this point, or is that?
You missed the drool. The drool was last segment.
Okay, because I remembered it in the past. I couldn't see it in the segment that I looked at because of the quality of the picture wasn't perfect. But I was like, wow, he's drooling. You don't see that going that far a lot.
Yeah, no, Joe Dater got the drool. So
okay. I'm sure he had a lot to say about salivary glands. And, but yeah, nice touch. I like people when they get on when they get like sloppy, when they do a sloppy cry, their nose gets red, their eyes get
right.
puffy.
You sometimes get a little like booger bubble coming out of their nostril. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh no, he's all in with this. And then he says, and then he doubles down on the dream. But I didn't just kill you.
Please tell me more about what you did to me and my son. Yes, please.
I cut you up into little pieces.
And he didn't stack them neatly like cordwood. Yes. It was a mess.
No neatness involved. This was, And he says, and interestingly, the next thing he says is, my God, I must be losing my mind. And that's actually kind of interesting because as I was saying this in the last episode, I mean, this is, and I think it was, I think someone had brought this up before, which was, I think Stuart Thorndike, who had guested a bunch of episodes back, had mentioned that this was kind of a moment of clarity for Jack. And I think that is what's interesting here. This is probably the only episode in the whole movie where he has a little insight and he's like, oh, my God, what's wrong with me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Is he really having a nightmare, or is that just kind of like a, I don't know if you call, I mean, he was actually asleep when he had this.
Yeah, he was actually asleep, which, you know, I think that the hotel, it's been, you know, pretty clear that the hotel's been sort of keeping him awake. You know, when he was sitting on his bed and Danny was like, Dad, why aren't you sleeping? You know, and he's like, can't sleep, too much work. I think it's, you know, clearly the hotel is keeping him awake, which is part of its whole, you know, mind fuck of this guy. And so he actually got a little sleep. You know, he actually just collapsed at the table, fell asleep, and it brought to him, you know, because it was restorative, a moment of clarity of like, I must be losing my mind, you know, and it's and even since the absolute beginning of the movie, we really never saw him say anything like that. It's always been, you know, he's always been pretty aggressive.
Yeah.
So it's
interesting. I'm fine. It's you that are keeping me from doing my work.
Right.
Yeah.
I just rewatched, just for funsies, I just rewatched The Jinx. And I was
killed
getting
them all, of course.
Yes, killed them all, of course. I was getting just a touch of that facial tick. You know, we're just right in this little moment here. Mm. Not identical, but some sort of awareness, some sort of nervous, weird, like, I don't know what these facial tics are. Some things that I didn't understand that I thought, it just reminded me of that, you know, mm-hmm. just this movements where your body or your face is sort of telling the people around you a different story than what you are maybe saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting scene. She says everything's going to be all right. Come on, here, let's get up off the floor. You know, she just, you know, will not stop being Wendy.
Yep.
So before we leave this part, you know, and sort of Danny comes walking in. But before we leave this part, let's talk a little bit about this dynamic, since I have a couple ladies here. You know, this is, some may say Wendy seems a little pathetic in what she's doing. I just want to talk again about the role of, and really dig into it a little bit, the role of women in horror movies, since we have a wonderful example of Cabin in the Woods, actually, which I just rewatched, knowing that you're going to be on. What a great female role that is. And, you know, let's just talk about sort of the evolution of females in horror movies. Interestingly, I was reading that, you know, when you look at the, what's it called, the Bechdel test?
Yeah.
Or, and then there's now like a Gina Davis, some kind of test that she has too, where you sort of figure out how much a woman is speaking and participating in the movie. And interestingly, horror movies are far and away, you know, there's way more female interaction, way more female screen time, way more female dialogue. It's sort of an interesting paradox almost, because women are generally the victims and are being axed and chased after, you know, with knives and are, you know, it come from, you know, the earliest horror movies. You had women. So let's say the first horror movie might be Nosferatu. The woman just faints when she sees Nosferatu. And that's kind of where we started, with women being the victims, women being very weak.
She also figures out how to sort of defeat him, in that she keeps him in her room until the daylight.
And
the daylight kills him. So she kind of sacrifices herself. So I guess that's, you know, once again, it's like they're the victims, but also in the fact that they're expected to sacrifice themselves for the greater cause.
Excellent point. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, and of course, you know, most of the roles in the 20s and 30s and even the 40s, it's, you know, horror film was still completely male-dominated. The monsters were male, and most of the protagonists were male. We evolved into more female roles like Cat People, 1942, Eyes Without a Face, 1960. Bride of Frankenstein, of course, we had your mm-hmm. one of your first female yes. monsters. The Innocents, I still think, is a very significant movie. I had mentioned it in another episode. That was 1961, and that's one of, you know, the first roles where it's a woman, Deborah Carr, as the lead, who's kind of, you know, the protagonist of the movie, and who's keeping, you know, everything going, and who has control over what's going on, even though she's, you know, she kind of is one of the earlier Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween roles.
Right.
You know what I mean?
The sort of the final girl.
Yeah. And like you know, she's the lead and has a lot of personality. It's not just like this victim. She's, you know, actually, if everything's happening to her and she's not in control, but she's, you know, moving the story along, and she's the one who kind of is the one who's discovering everything as it's going on. And then Carnival of Souls in 1962, it's hard to underestimate how really amazingly influential that movie was, with a female lead who was very, you know, such an interesting type, full of personality, facing these, you know, horrible creatures. Let's see, we had The Haunting, which was more of an ensemble cast.
Yeah, I was going to say, speaking of women who are expected to sacrifice themselves.
Yeah. And Repulsion, 1965, where a female who was pretty much, you know, both victim and monster at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then we come to, like, Rosemary's Baby, where I think we start getting, and again, you know, Polanski, God bless him and curse him at the same time.
Yes.
Man, that movie, I mean, Maria Farrow is, that's where you start getting a hero. You know, that's the beginning, I think, of the female hero, even though, you know, she ends up absolutely losing at the end. She is there is, you know, a feeling of heroism in her role. And I think that's kind of what began, you know, the evolution into, like, again, Halloween with Jamie Lee Curtis. Anyway. So I just wanted to go over that a little bit. Do you guys have any favorite female leads as far as protagonists or victims or monsters?
Yeah, well, I was going to say that just recent films that I've enjoyed with female leads are The Love Witch.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I aesthetically enjoyed that film, and I think in a previous recent episode, well, probably several episodes of your podcast, Susan, that you guys have talked about the humor, you know, in a something, whether it's dark humor, overt or real subtle. And I think with that one, there's a lot of subtle humor, but also the costuming and the aesthetic of the whole film was really interesting and
yeah.
Mostly 60s, but then somebody whips out a cell phone at a certain point.
It's a weird movie. Yeah,
I would love it if there was an actual place somewhere around here that was a big Victorian house that had high tea where everyone wore the big, like, it's almost like the Stepford Wives with the big high neck dresses and the
right.
Victorian hats eating, you know, various sugary desserts and tea. This yeah. big, giant pink house.
Yeah, she went full feminine, which was awesome. Yes. I'm not in love with that movie. I wish she had let the pace get a little... There's something, you know, I know what she was going for with the directing, but I wish mm-hmm. the pace had been picked up a little bit. But it's worth seeing. It's beautifully shot. The colors are amazing. She's like old, out of commission Kodak film or something to shoot it. I forget how that works. Huh. But she got amazing color from, you know, very specialized film. And
she made the rug. She made the big pentagram, the big pentagram rug. She made it herself.
Yeah,
She made a lot of that film herself yeah. from the yeah. music to the... I forget how much. I mean, it was just like, oh, this and this and this.
Yeah,
the costumes
yeah.
and
makes someone like Robert Rodriguez look like a lazy ass in comparison. It's like, totally. Oh, you only had six jobs? Pfft, you didn't make a rug, did you?
Yeah, Anna Biller, and she's yes. somebody I follow on Twitter. I don't know about you, lady.
Yeah, me
she's
too.
She's a great, yes. great person to follow. But yeah, also I was thinking of Your Next. I really enjoyed.
Oh, that was really good. Yeah, I really liked that one too.
That mm-hmm. the lead of that, she's definitely mm-hmm. you know, clever. She's the final, but she's not a yeah. She's clever from beginning to end, and I feel like mm-hmm. you could follow along with her and feel like you're an empowered, you know, female person.
Yeah.
It feels like now, contemporary, the vast majority of the leads in horror are female, that it's become now the norm, which is fantastic, you know. And mm-hmm. I mean, look at over the last year, what was that one that was the almost like a Groundhog's Day of horror?
Oh, Happy Death Day?
Yeah, Happy Death Day came out this year.
Yes.
I mean, obviously It Follows was yeah, very
the
female. The Witch was amazing. And I mean, and they're all such good yeah. movies, you know, too.
One that I really liked, and I think you also mentioned it, Susan, is the French movie Raw.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that was really amazing.
Excellent. Yeah, that's female directed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it's fantastic.
With sister protagonists. Yeah.
Beautifully shot. That's been streaming on Netflix. If you have Netflix, you can check that out pretty easily, at least last I looked. And then, of course, I've mentioned The Babadook a few times. That's already getting old now. But we've had so many great female-led... Let the Right One In. You know, a lot of yes. Japanese stuff, a lot of overseas stuff. Yeah, it's just... we are in a time where it's actually, I think, preferred and the norm. And apparently, audience-wise, for horror films, it's now over 50% of the audience is female. So they're, you know, they're acknowledging, even the makers of these films are acknowledging that this is our audience. The audience is female. And I think that's interesting, too. And I think it makes perfect sense because we live our lives kind of as prey, you know, I mean, as far as, you know, not to sound like we're perpetual victims, but we do tend to be in that role of always having to be looking over our shoulder and, you know, at night and all that stuff. And so it makes sense that we enjoy facing those fears so that we can feel control over that, that would be more thrilling for us in a way almost than the male experience. And I think that's why we've also have been moving away from slasher films, because it's like, you know, do you guys like slasher films? I mean, I think that's more of a male enjoyment thing.
Yeah, I'm not huge on slasher films. The things I like about them are the kind of things that I relate to as an audience member, like at least for the first part of High Tension before they go in for the twist, it kind of in like emergency mode, kind of yeah. thinking of what you need to do. But whereas ones like, you know, Friday the 13th, how like with the first films especially, the victims seem to get especially stupid. Like, they may have been, like, sassy, independent, seemingly modern women, but the minute somebody's in front of them with a weapon, they just kind of give up and go, you know, go ahead and kill me. Go ahead and put an axe in my head. Oh, dear. You know, it's like they just seem to forget to, like, not just run, but do anything to avoid being killed.
Right. Except for Jamie Lee Curtis. Like, Halloween was a good one because she was definitely, like, being the outsmarting the killer. And then the one after that, so that was 70, Halloween was 78. And then I guess Nightmare on Elm Street came out after that. And
that's right. That was a female led. Yeah, I guess it's like Final Girl, but she was a little more involved in the plot than the other ones, which is just kind of like, well, we just killed off everybody else and never got really to know much more about them, except that I can't remember what the name of the last girl in the beginning of the first Friday the 13th. I can't remember her name much about her, except she was very modestly clothed and had boyish cut hair and didn't take off much clothing during strip Monopoly.
Yes, right. Well, and now think that this is all contemporary now, what we're talking about with The Shining. So they were filming in 78, 79, it came out in 80. And so you had Suspiria in 77, you had Halloween in 78, and then I guess, I forget when Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th came out, but...
Like early, Friday the 13th, I think, was early, like 1980?
Okay, so that had
80, 81, and then Nightmare on Elm Street, I think, was like 84.
So out of all those movies, the only one I rewatch is Suspiria, of the ones you're mentioning.
Oh, yeah, so I love Suspiria.
I guess that kind of answers the question. I remember enjoying, I feel like what, you know, the older I get, the more I learn what my taste is. And it's enjoying some of the action where you are kind of like, oh, they're thinking on their feet. I'm, you know, what would I do if I was in this position? Then that can be exciting. Mm-hmm. And then if something's, you know, funny, that always, or if that, so there's a moodiness or a beauty to the way it's shot. And I think with Suspiria, I never really remember what happens in it. I just remember how I feel watching.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's one of those films that nowadays you'd get a lot of people watch it and saying, but it doesn't make sense. And it's like, you know, watching it, I don't really think of like, well, why is this school there? Why are they doing this? What is their...
You can enjoy life a lot more if you're not attached to outcome.
Exactly. Yeah. You know? Or the whole like reason behind. It seems like a lot of modern audiences have an obsession with what's this person's backstory? What's this person's motivation? It's like, I don't need to know that. I'm fine with just, you know, there just happens to be a ballet school full of witches, you know, just cause.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts? Do you have any feelings about it being remade?
Oh, God, I didn't even know about that. I'm not happy.
I don't know. I don't quite know why they felt like, I mean, they have some interesting people. It's the person who did Call Me By Your Name.
I don't know. I don't know anything about it, actually.
Yeah, I think it's him, and I think it's with Tilda Swinton and a few other. Like he's done good, interesting work.
But yeah, it seems kind of pointless. Like again, because it is Suspiria is what it is because of the atmosphere of the, you know, that is a real
production. The production design.
Yeah.
The look of the whole thing. It's just this gorgeous,
the music,
the sound design, the music.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, I love the soundtrack. It's great alarm clock music. Yeah.
So it's like, what are you going to, you know, we already know the colors, you know, the colors are so important. Mm. Like, what are you going to redo all of that? Like, you know, or you can go I guess he could do the opposite and just like try to tell the same story, you know, flipping all of that. But what's, you know, again, what's the point really? I don't know, but in any case, it'll be, certainly people will go to see it. So that's why, you know, that's why they
stuff gonna... like that. I feel like I'm not really personally interested in, you know, remakes most times. So like, I just kind of go, oh, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
But I do feel like if somebody, a creative person, whoever the director is, that for them, when I think of them, I think, oh, well, maybe this is something they've enjoyed for a long time and they feel like they have something to say or are challenged to themselves, you know, that I feel glad for them if they decide that they're going to do it just to see what kind of art comes of it, whether I end up enjoying it or not. It's like they're just an experiment for them.
Yeah. It's like the thing, the original, The Thing from Another World didn't really need to be remade, but I'm glad John Carpenter, I saw him once before a screening of his version of The Thing, and he had the guy asked him about, why did you decide to do a remake of this? And in his inimitable, cranky, chain-smoking style, he kind of rolled his eyes and was like, there's really basically two kinds of horror films. The kind where the threat comes from out there, and there's the threat, the monster that comes from inside. So in the first film, it was like the monster from outside, from out there, coming in to attack them all. And he was like, what about doing it the other way so that it's literally inside them and they can't tell which one it is. So,
yeah,
you know, he at least had a good grasp on like what it was that, you know, telling it from a different cultural point of view, the same thing with The Fly.
Yes,
remake that Cronenberg did.
Right. Well, in both of those cases, the movies were from two different eras. Or Invasion of the Body Snatchers was a great remake.
Right.
But they're kind of from two different eras, and of course the technology has advanced. So I suppose, you know, but it just seems like they're so much more story driven. Like Invasion of the Body Snatchers is just a great story. You know, the remake kind of feels like it makes more sense, whereas, like, again, Suspiria doesn't quite. But, yeah, I mean, like, why not? I mean, I shouldn't. The director, by the way, is Luca Guadagnino. How do we pronounce this?
Guadagnino.
Guadagnino. Guadagnino. Mm-hmm. Italian.
Yeah, and I'm looking and I see that Chloe Grace Moritz and Dakota Johnson and Tilda Swinton. I'll pretty much see anything Tilda Swinton's in.
Yes.
So I'm pretty sure I'm on board.
Just also to just talk about Wendy again, and in contrast, this movie, which came out in 1980, with other things that were coming out at the same time. So again, Halloween came out in 78, and of course Carrie was out. What year was that?
I love Carrie.
And then you had 79, so it came out right before The Shining was Alien.
Carrie was 76, yeah.
Yeah, well, Carrie was 76, okay. But yeah, Alien was 79, and of course Ridley Scott loved Kubrick. I mean, he worshipped Kubrick. Ridley Scott's first movie was like a tribute to Barry Lyndon, and a really great one too. And you know, Alien would not have existed without 2001. But it's interesting that Ridley Scott was such a different kind of director when it came to women. Of course, he eventually did Thelma and Louise, which is one of the greatest feminist movies, you know, in the universe. And always had amazing female protagonists. And I believe it was his choice to have Ripley as the hero of Alien. Mm-hmm. Originally, it was a male. And so it's interesting to think about the difference between Kubrick and what he did with Wendy. And I, you know, like to argue Wendy is a, you know, she's, you know, really, again, the caretaker. She's the person who's trying to keep the family together. She's a feminine archetype that's a little outdated at this point, because she's being a little bit, you know, of course, some people think she's being kind of pathetic and weak. I don't think that's true.
She's just a quiet, timid person. I mean, she's not an outgoing, you know, I'm sorry, she can't be as strong and outgoing and, you know, type A, go get him personality. But I mean, she manages to sort of...
She is full of love and nurturing, which is you know, when you look at like, I keep forgetting Jamie Lee Curtis's character's name, Laurie, whatever it was in Halloween. Laurie Strode. You know, they made her like kind of a tough androgynous girl a little bit. Ripley is kind of a tough androgynous girl. And, you know, they always gave these females male names to kind of, you know, like, you know, they often did. That was often the case. The Friday 13th, I think her name was Sydney, or there's Sydney's and, you know, Georgie's. And they always give them sort of slightly androgynous names, androgynous looks. They're always the girls who are not making out with the boys as much. And they're the heroes. And Wendy is, you know, this other kind of female hero. And I like to argue that, you know, people don't see her as a hero because it's just something you're not used to seeing at all. And of course, you know, again, it's contrasting at this point in movie history with, you know, these other horror movies. But in any case, you know, Wendy has her place.
I totally agree with you, too. And I think when I was younger and I first saw this film, I probably, you know, if memory serves me, you know, didn't think too much of Wendy or thought she was kind of annoying. But then as I got older and developed more of a sense of compassion, and I realized, oh, wow, this person is, she's playing a particular type of role, but it is very nurturing, and she's trying to take care of everybody, which isn't a weak thing to do. It's right. The opposite of that.
No.
And she's taking, you've said over and again, but she's the one that's the true caretaker and is, you know, like you said, she was downstairs. So she's running up to take care of him. And then she's, you know, later on we see her taking care of Danny. And so there's nothing weak about any of that.
Right.
You know?
And people just don't look at nurturing and, you know, this outpouring of love, which is what she's doing. She's pouring out love to Jack right now underneath the table. She wants him to feel better. She wants so badly for him to be okay, despite everything he's done to her. And
yeah, it's putting aside her own fear of like, what right. she knows he's capable of doing.
And people just don't look at that as a strong trait, you know, and that's kind of, you know, you can get into the larger concept of this with female leaders, you know, female political leaders who, you know, are more wanting to cooperate, you know, and more cooperative and who are more peaceful. And, you know, there's just been study after study showing this. And, you know, it's in contrast with male leaders. And we just are still not quite at that point where we're understanding as a civilization that these are the qualities that are actually more valuable and are actually, you know, should be looked upon as strong. So,
well, that's what I love about in, you know, modern movies, how our leaders are turning more towards compassion, like in the Marvel movies or even in Wonder Woman, which is not a Marvel movie, but in the other, in like Black Panther, it's to lead with compassion. It's to lead with love that is going to take over, and the women are teaching the men, and they're showing this balance of physical strength, like that you can, not every woman in, say, Black Panther has the same role. They're not all identical, but they each have certain strengths that are going to help, you know, help the king and support the king. But, you know, I don't, you know, we don't really need the king to be there. He's great, you know, but I mean, that whole group of women could handle all the stuff that needs to happen.
So, yeah, maybe this is, you know, this is what movies need. Definitely. I think Wendy, even, you know, a decade or so from now, may be looked upon much differently.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get back to our scene here in Shining Land. So now we cut to Danny. The back of Danny, and he comes wandering in. It's a really weird shot because it's just like the Steadicam's just kind of walking behind him. He's at the very bottom of the screen, and their parents are way off, you know, in the distance. And Wendy's just totally confused at this point. She's like, Danny, everything's okay. Just go play in your room for a while. Your dad's just got a headache. Danny, mind what I say? Go play in your room. She's just like, oh my God, what the hell? You know? And then she sees the bruises on this kid's neck. Now, in the book, so in the movie, we are just completely skipping over what happened in the bathroom, which I think is a good artistic choice.
Yes. Yes.
I think, you know, it's one of those things where whatever you can picture in your mind having happened to Danny is going to be way worse than, you know, anything they could have depicted on screen, right?
Yes. I have no need to see a naked, rotting woman go after a little boy. No, thank you.
But do you want to hear it? Do you want to hear it? I guess I have the book and I could read you that.
Oh, yes, but I do want to hear it. Yes, please, share.
I thought it would be fun to read it because it's a fun scene. Yes. It's very short. So Danny, in the book, he had stolen the passkey, and he decides to go in the room. And so It's a long room, old-fashioned like a Pullman car. This is the bathroom. Tiny white hexagonal tiles on the floor. At the far end, a toilet with the lid up. At the right, a wash basin and another mirror above it, and the kind that hides a medicine cabinet. To the left, a huge white tub on claw feet, the shower curtain pulled closed. Danny stepped into the bathroom and walked toward the tub dreamily, as if propelled from something outside himself. As if this whole thing were one of the dreams Tony had brought him, that he would perhaps see something nice when he pulled the shower curtain back. Something Daddy had forgotten or Mommy had lost. Something that would make them both happy. So he pulled the shower curtain back. The woman in the tub had been dead for a long time. She was bloated and purple, her gas-filled belly rising out of the cold, ice-rimmed water like some fleshy island. Her eyes were fixed on Danny's, glassy and huge like marbles. She was grinning, her purple lips pulled back in a grimace. Her breasts lolled, L-O-L-L-E-D, yes. Of course. Yes. Her pubic hair floated. This is so Stephen King. This is so Stephen King.
Why, Steve? Why? Damn it, Steve.
Her hands were frozen on the knurled porcelain sides of the tub like crab claws. Danny shrieked, but the sound never escaped his lips. Turning inward and inward, it fell down in his darkness like a stone in a well. He took a single blundering step forward, hearing his heels clack on the white hexagonal tiles, and at the same moment, his urine broke, spilling effortlessly out of him. So Daniel Lloyd, thank your lucky stars, you didn't have to do that scene. The woman was sitting up, still grinning, her huge marble eyes fixed on him. She was sitting up. Her dead palms made squittering noises on the porcelain. Her breasts
squittering.
Squittering. It's a great word.
That's a very Lovecraftian word.
Squittering. Yeah. I don't know if it's real, but it works. Her breasts swayed like ancient cracked punching bags. Mm-hmm. Steven, there was the minute sound of breaking ice shards. She was not breathing. She was a corpse and dead long years. Danny turned and ran, bolting through the bathroom doors. He ran full tilt outside into the outside door of 217, which had now closed. And I'll skip a little bit here. And he's outside the door. He's sort of yelling to Dick Halloran. He's thinking about Dick Halloran in his mind. And Dick's saying, I don't think they can hurt you. They're like pictures in a book. Close your eyes and they'll be gone. His eyelids snapped down. His hands curled into balls. His shoulders hunched with the effort of his concentration. Nothing there. Nothing there. Not there. Not at all. Nothing there. Nothing is there. Time passed and he was just beginning to relax. Just beginning to realize that the door must be unlocked and he could go. When the years damped, bloated, fish-smelling hands closed softly around his throat, and he was turned implacably around to stare into that dead and purple face. Ugh. End of chapter, and that's all we're going to hear. That's all he says about that scene. But so that's what actually happened.
So no wonder he's sucking his thumb.
Yes, no wonder he's sucking his thumb.
Yeah, that'll that's where that sends you.
Yeah. And yeah, so, you know, I mean, and the fact that his sweater here is torn, my God, you know, that just adds so much to the visual of what must have happened.
It's such a nice sweater. It almost looks homemade.
It does look, I'm sure it was homemade. I'm sure Cooper was like, make me an Apollo 11 sweater.
And I'm sure you can also Google it and look for it and somebody will have a pattern for it on the web somewhere.
I actually asked Danny Lloyd, Dan Lloyd is on Twitter, and I asked him, did you pick that? Did you have like a choice of sweaters? And he said, you know, as far as he remembers, he was given that sweater. And that makes sense because, I mean, like I had talked about in my last episode, Kubrick was known for the moon landing, the fake moon landing. I'm sure he was like, he was just busting our balls using that sweater. I think he was like, wink, wink. Oh, yes, moon landing. Here you go. Here it is right in front of you. Mm-hmm. And all right, so she says, oh my God, Danny, what happened to your neck? Danny, what happened to your neck? And she picks him up, and here we have...
And he changes.
We have the debut, when she's standing, of Dummy Danny. Mm. That is not a real child right there. That is a prop made to look like
That's
Danny.
That's a good prop.
It's a very good prop. This is the first time we'll see this. We'll be seeing this a bunch of times during the movie. Danny, of course, you know, he was a 5.5-year-old. He's kind of, you know, it would have been a lot of, you know, God knows, Shelley Duvall had enough work without having to carry around a kid, yeah, you know, through this whole rest
Shelley Duvall is probably 80 pounds soaking wet.
Right.
The fact she has to pick up and hold a child at, like, you know, that's probably half her weight.
And also, and then,
that's
and then,
a bit much to ask.
Additionally, yeah, you know, because Danny was a little kid, he could only be working a very few hours per day, you know, according to laws. So they made this dummy. Mm-hmm. The best part is the hand. I mean, it really looks like a kid's hand.
That's what I was looking at.
It's kind of the essential part. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I never knew that. I had no idea. I would never have guessed it unless I had read it. But that is a fake child. And as she walks away, Jack has this look on his face just like, what? I mean, he has his hand up in the air. Like,
yeah, that's a great, like, if you look for, like, gifts and you look like disbelieving, like, look of disbelief,
yeah,
startled disbelief. That's it right there.
And she's like, you did this to him. She said, you did this to him, didn't you? You son of a bitch. And that's the first thing she ever says that's like that. You did this to him, didn't you? How could you? How could you? Wonderful acting by Shelley Duvall. Both of them are amazing. And then we have a nice crossfade into the next scene, which is we are going into the gold ballroom hallway. So that's exciting. But let me ask you, Heidi, about your memories of The Shining the first time you saw it, what it means to you, you know, what how it fits into your life, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I really can't remember, you know, the exact, you know, first time I saw it. I definitely know I saw it in, you know, in the 80s. I don't believe I went to see it in the theater, so it was probably on VHS, probably at a friend's house. I had one friend who it seemed like either she or, you know, somebody in our circle was always getting the interesting movies. And she was one of those friends whose parents were like, oh, we'll be in the bedroom. You guys watch whatever, you know, and they kind of let us watch all sorts of crazy, maybe inappropriate movies. But I feel like it's stuck with me. This movie and a few others have stuck with me in my memories as being a person whose mom, not my father, but a second person that she married, was an abusive person. And so I remember watching this. I remember, you know, artistically enjoying it. I was actually just looking at an old picture of me from the 80s, and I was like a little, you know, punk new wave weirdo kid, and
yeah,
definitely was interested and saw a ton of movies. I mean, absolutely just was immersed in seeing film. And my dad used to take me to movies a lot. And then also he had like books on cult films and things. So he turned me on to a lot of interesting things. So I know I liked it. I know I liked it at first viewing, but as my mom's relationship and in turn my relationship with this abuser got more intense, I realized that, oh, this movie's a little too close to what's going on in my life as far as being around somebody who's being abusive, you know? And I just happened to remember too that right at the tail end of her living with this guy that this movie was on. I was over at their apartment and it was on like probably just regular television or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember watching it and at that point realizing like, I don't know whatever I need to do to help her get out of this. I need to do it, you know? So I called her on later on in the week and said, you know, I can go over to your house while you're at work, because she worked with this guy.
Yeah.
You know, one of those creepy relationships where the person's always with you at home and at work.
Wow.
And
boundaries.
I said,
what are boundaries?
Exactly. I said, you know, I can't remember exactly, but something to the effect of, you know, leave your key under the mat. And while you're at work with him, I will come over with a truck and my family. So my mom's first husband, my dad, and we will pack up everything of yours and move you away. And
wow.
And we did. So I do have it tied into those kind of, you know, emotional,
yeah,
turbulent parts of my life. And then I remember being a Kubrick fan, but over time having more of a relationship to movies like Fanny and Alexander and Night of the Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
I think because of the children being connected to this abusive, you know, man and having to escape these abusive relationships. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're not the first person to be on this podcast who has connected it to childhood and, you know, witnessing that kind of stuff. So he definitely, you know, clearly captured, you know, in a way that resonates with people, that kind of feeling between a man and a woman, the kind of stuff that, yeah. And of course, from Danny's perspective, what he would have been feeling, you know, which we don't see too much in the movie, him sort of witnessing their stuff, but you know, it's obviously in the backstory, you know, it would be him witnessing this kind of behavior. So certainly in the book, certainly very much in the book. You look at Clockwork Orange and, you know, Dr. Strangelove, and he captures sort of a toxic masculinity, but it's very much detached, you know, from reality. You know, it's exaggerated to the point of absurdity, but this really captures something real.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you look at something like this and you see them, they're more grounded in reality in that their clothing and the set design are, you know, you can see eras of this hotel being, you know, maybe redecorated at different points or new furniture coming in and stuff. But when you look at them and their clothing, you go, oh, these are people in my time. Like the way it's shot, like when you see the two of them under the table next to each other, like you're under the table with them. They're not far away. You're part of what's going on.
Yes. Yes. Heidi, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It's been really fantastic listening in to, you know, and I applaud you for being the, you know, producer and running this whole thing. You know, I know it takes a village, you know, we get help from other people, but to take this on your own, I really applaud you.
The caretaker.
Doing this, yes, being the caretaker.
You've always been the caretaker, Susan.
I have fucking always been the fucking caretaker. And again, Heidi, it's heidibennett.com, right? We can find your...
Yes. Heidibennett.com. And two N's, two T's.
Two N's, two T's.
Huge thanks to Heidi Bennett from Cabin Minute Cast and Spinal Tap Minute, and to Megan Dooley for being on the show. And we actually talked a whole lot more about Cabin in the Woods, about Ready Player One again, and we talked about The Shining a little bit more, connecting all three of those movies, actually. So I'm posting the extra content on my Patreon account. So for just $3.50 a month, I post a lot of extra bonus content coming from the episodes, and also about other Kubrick movies and just about all kinds of things. So please check that out. That's at Patreon, patreon.com/The Shining 237, or you can just find the link on my regular website, theshining237.com. That will take you there. Please follow The Shining 237 on Twitter and Facebook, and subscribe on iTunes. And if you like the show, leave a review. Next week, I have a very special returning guests, film and television critic Tasha Robinson from The Verge and from the wonderful podcast The Next Picture Show, along with Bob Kester, who does the Immunities sci-fi podcast drama. So please come back for next week's episode number 25, when we will be hearing Lloyd the bartender say, what'll it be?
I know all my whole life through.